Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
In Moscow today, the military out in force to mark Victory Day when the Soviets defeated Nazi Germany. Under Vladimir Putin, the day has taken on new meaning.
There's this great Russian word, Победа бесия, which could translate as victory mania or victory derangement syndrome.
Also today, India is withering in extreme heat, and the long-term outlook isn't good.
Most models are telling us the future is going to be warmer.
As in many places, a changing climate is hitting some Indians harder than others. I'm Marco Werman, and in Colombia, a drug cartel is paralyzing part of the country.
By telling shops they can't open, by telling bus companies and vehicles they cannot move, and generally creating as much disruption as they possibly can.
Because their boss is in U.S. custody. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us. May 9th in Russia is almost a sacred day, Victory Day, marking the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany on the Eastern Front during World War II. This was today in Moscow. A massive display of Russian troops in Red Square saluting Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin used today's celebration to stir up Russian pride. He also falsely described today's war in Ukraine as a fight against Nazism. Max Seddon was taking in the day's events. He's the Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times, but currently based in Riga, Latvia. You were tweeting a lot of the images from Russian TV, Max. It almost seemed like you were on the ground in Moscow. What were you seeing all day, and what stood out to you most?
Well, it's the usual picture under Putin that we are treated to on Victory Day. It's all of the tanks and intercontinental ballistic missiles and troops marching past, except the difference here is that this was while Russia was fighting war in Ukraine at the very same time. It's this pretty perverted telling of history that he has had a lot of success in getting people to sign up to. Russia is nobly fighting Nazis, only this time the Nazis are American puppets from Ukraine.
Well, as you know, in the days leading up to today, Victory Day, some analysts were worried that Putin might use the day to rally Russia to a wider war. So what happened instead? Was it all artifice today?
I've been doing this long enough that I know that, you know, waiting for Putin to announce specific things on a specific date is often a fool's errand. He likes to keep people on their toes. So it may have just been, you know, Western analysts and Ukrainian officials who are putting a little too much stock in the date. So we didn't see Putin announce things that he still could announce, even though he didn't announce them today. Mm. What this does is it allows Putin to make it clear that this is not just the short blitzkrieg that he thought Russia was going to do at the start when they thought by day three the Victory Day parade would be in Kyiv. This would be preparing the Russian population for a much longer war, and the Russian state TV for the last month or so has made a lot of effort to frame when they say, why haven't we won yet? It's because we're not fighting the Ukrainians. We are fighting America and NATO. But we didn't see much of that today. This was much more about framing the war in historical context. Mm. He said that the Russian troops were fighting on their own lands, which is more indication that Russia doesn't intend to give back any of the Ukrainian territory it's annexed. There was absolutely no mention, but what was completely missing from the Victory Day speech, he didn't talk about any kind of victory in this war. There was no indication whatsoever of how it could end, when it could end, what exactly a victory would even mean. There was really no future at all. It was just completely focused on the past to justify his actions.
The fact that Putin did not take the opportunity for more saber-rattling or more, did that surprise you? And what do you think it says that Putin did not trumpet what he calls the special military operation in Ukraine?
I don't think it necessarily means very much, because ultimately the goals and the things that have been driving Putin to do this is all coming from resentments that he's had for decades against Ukraine for having the audacity to exist in its current form, which is something that he very clearly strongly objects to, and against the West for what he sees as his plan to humiliate Russia after the Soviet Union collapsed, and then encircle the country and try to overthrow his government. This is something that he appears to genuinely believe. Different parts of the narrative have dropped in and out, sometimes on state TV or Putin himself. They're talking a lot about denazification, this extremely vague goal that he set that appears to mean completely eradicating all Ukrainian national identity. But then there were quite long periods where no one used the word whatsoever, not Putin, not his press secretary, not the military. It disappeared from state TV for a while. They stopped talking about it in peace negotiations. And then suddenly it came roaring back.
Finally, Max, what is the most interesting or compelling thing you witnessed or were told about how Victory Day went?
I think what's really remarkable and also quite depressing is how in some sectors of Russian society, there is this sentiment that what Putin has done, it is just so divorced from the actual experience and memory of the Soviet victory in World War II, that it is almost an insult to that memory. And it is by twisting history for political ends in that way that has led Russia to do some of the horrible things that it has done. Putin has basically elevated World War II to the level of the state religion. There's actually this army cathedral outside Moscow, which is basically this weird, almost kind of paganistic war cult temple, where the whole thing is painted this khaki camouflage colors. The floors are made out of melted down Wehrmacht panzer tanks.
Wow.
There's this great Russian word, Pobeda Besia, which you could translate as victory mania or victory derangement syndrome.
Well, later in the program, we'll have more on the day's events and the history of Victory Day in Russia. Max Seddon, the Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times. He's currently in Riga, Latvia. Max, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
In the Philippines, the final votes for their next president are still to be tallied, but Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has a commanding lead. Marcos is the son of late dictator Ferdinand Marcos. The younger Marcos, commonly known as Bongbong or BBM, addressed his supporters a few hours ago.
Hindi pa tapos ang bilangan.
A lot of people say that it's done, but it's not yet done. That's why we have to wait until it's all clear, 100% until we celebrate.
Not yet done. Reporter Ashley Westerman has been roving around the Philippine capital, Manila, all day speaking with voters, and she joins us now. Ashley, was Marcos expected to do this well in the vote?
Yes, Marco, he was. Polling has consistently put Marcos in the front of the pack. The last Pulse Asia poll before the election had him at 56%, with Vice President Lenny Robredo in a distant second at 24%. And since the polls closed at 7 p.m. here, he is millions of votes ahead of Robredo. Maria Ella Antienza is a political scientist at University of the Philippines, Diliman.
It's a big lead already for Bongbong Marcos, so it looks like it will be him, but it will not be smooth sailing for him. He still has disqualification cases, and you have people who are dissatisfied with the conduct of the elections.
And Atienza says it will likely take until the end of the month to resolve all these issues and for the Senate to certify the votes for president and make everything official.
Yeah, explain what these issues are. People dissatisfied with the conduct of the election. What's that about?
Yeah, so today was punctuated with several reports of violence throughout the country, as well as voting machine malfunctions that left thousands who could not cast a ballot when the polls closed. We went to one polling place around 8 p.m. in the neighborhood of Pembo in Makati City, where more than 300 people who hadn't voted yet were lined up outside of an elementary school saying the gates had been closed on them. Here's Evelyn Corpuz, who said she has been waiting 11 hours to vote. She says when she showed up this morning, the machines were broken and they were told to go home.
So they told us about 7, you come back, because the Peter's machine will be repaired. And I can no longer get inside. So what's that? What is freedom here?
And the Commission on Elections is going to have to address these issues.
Yeah. So it's not over yet. But what is the feeling on the ground right now?
Well, understandably, Lenny fans are upset and disappointed with the returns so far, especially because many feel Bongbong has used social media to rewrite his family's infamous legacy. You have to remember Bongbong's father's dictatorship through the 1960s, 70s and 80s. It was marked by a poor economy, unbridled corruption, the stealing of billions of dollars from the Filipino people, and several human rights violations. And even though these things have been thoroughly documented, the Marcos family has successfully wielded social media as a platform to rewrite that history. And when I say that, I mean saying that actually the regime was like the golden era of the Philippines and things were really prosperous and everyone was living really, really well. Meanwhile, Bongbong fans are celebrating tonight. My colleague Bernard Custodio and I were at BBM's headquarters just a while ago, and this was the scene. There we ran into Yancy Tan, who said Marcos's win is an answered prayer.
I hope the next administration sana smooth ang gobyerno.
Tan says he hopes through BBM's administration, every Filipino will unite and the government will rule steadily. He also says that this is a chance for the Marcoses to answer accusations against their family.
So assuming the tally continues at the current pace, how is Ferdinand Marcos Jr. expected to lead the country?
BBM is an ally of the current president, Rodrigo Duterte, so he's expected to continue many of the same policies that the Philippines has seen over the last 6 years. Domestically, experts are worried there will be more corruption during Marcos's administration, more nepotism. Basically, he's expected to put all his friends and allies in top positions. And he's also expected to continue President Duterte's deadly and controversial war on drugs, as well as Duterte's controversial infrastructure building policy. There will also be, you know, international effects. Marcos is expected to continue Duterte's policies of pursuing a bilateral relationship with China, as well as accepting more Chinese investment. But, you know, Marco, his policies are very vague. BBM and his running mate, Sara Duterte, who's the daughter of the current president and is also expected to win the vice presidency, they have this amorphous message of unity. Few details. But people seem to really be into this idea that the Philippines has to be united in order to get out of the economic slump caused by the pandemic. And people think that they can do that for them.
Reporter Ashley Westerman in Manila, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, a quick update to a story we've been following for several weeks. In Sri Lanka today, the prime minister resigned after a month of protests. Growing anger over a deep economic crisis there. Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa tweeted that he submitted his resignation to Sri Lanka's president, a man who happens to be his brother and who is also facing pressure to resign. Sri Lankans are dealing with food and fuel shortages as well as electricity cuts. The country is struggling to pay back its foreign debt and is working on a long-term rescue plan with the International Monetary Fund. Coming up, Germany faces a paradox, opposing Russia's war in Ukraine while relying on Russian oil and gas imports. That dilemma puts new pressure on German measures to address climate change. Our interview with the country's new climate envoy, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. Hi, Marco Werman. You're with The World. Germany is in a tough spot right now. It is heavily reliant on Russian energy, but with a war in Ukraine, Germany is rapidly trying to transition away from that dependency. How it does that will have a big impact on the country's climate goals and its reputation as an international leader on climate change. One person at the center of that effort is Jennifer Morgan, Germany's new climate envoy. She took the office just as the war in Ukraine started. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, spoke with Morgan in Berlin. I understand Jennifer Morgan has an interesting background, Carolyn. Tell us, first of all, who she is.
Yeah, Jennifer Morgan is originally from the U.S., but she's lived in Germany now for about 20 years. And she's a climate policy expert, a longtime leader at environmental NGOs, and a fixture at U.N. climate negotiations. She's kind of known for being able to work a room full of diplomats like almost no one else. But she moved to her job at Germany's foreign ministry directly from her position as executive director of Greenpeace International, a position that she held since 2016, which raised a few eyebrows in Germany. So I wanted to ask her, first off, how do you make the transition from head of an environmental NGO that's known for, among other things, stunts like activists chaining themselves to oil tankers, to being the top climate diplomat in Germany? And she told me, first off, you know, the goals are the same, preventing every tenth of a degree of global warming possible.
But obviously, the tools are different. So when you're a diplomat, you can still speak clear language across the table with your counterparts, but your main tools are dialogue, your main tools are partnerships, your main tools are negotiation, rather than kind of building pressure from the outside that NGOs, importantly, and civil society, importantly, does.
So, Carolyn, I mean, regardless of Morgan's path to this job, this would be a very challenging time to begin this kind of job full stop, as energy is such a huge thing right now with the war in Ukraine. I mean, Germany's long been an international leader on climate change. The Green Party has flourished there in ways it hasn't in other countries. Has the war changed that leadership role in any way?
Well, as you mentioned, Germany before the war was heavily dependent on Russian energy. And as it scrambles to try to diversify its sources and move away from that, there is concern both inside and outside the country that it might be putting some of its climate goals at risk with some of the really hard choices that it has to make. So one of the things I was really interested in asking Jennifer Morgan when I interviewed her at the foreign ministry in Berlin was, how has Germany's foreign policy changed since the start of the war in Ukraine? And here's how she answered.
Obviously, the horrific Russian war is top of the agenda. That means there's been a change in foreign policy about how we engage on the military side of things, security side of things. I think from a climate change perspective, it actually reinforces why we have to phase out fossil fuels. Because if you're dependent on Putin and Russia for your fossil fuels the way that Germany has been, it brings in not only the climate problem of being so dependent on fossil fuels, but also the energy security part of it. So I think it's given an additional push, actually, to accelerate the transformation to renewable energy and energy efficiency.
Scientists in the latest round of UN climate reports said that new fossil fuel infrastructure is not compatible with climate targets. Germany has proposed building a bunch of new liquefied natural gas terminals so that they can import liquefied natural gas and move away from piped gas from Russia. Does this plan reduce the credibility of Germany on climate change on an international stage?
The dilemma that we are in is immense. We need to end our dependence on Russia while remaining functional and being able to provide for our people, and at the same time address the climate crisis. And so I think, well, there's a set of bills on the table called the Easter Package of 500 pages of how to accelerate the energy renewables build out here. But in this acute phase, in the short term, having these LNG terminals come in is this compromise that's there. And I think the plan is to not make those long-term, but actually have shorter-term contracts there, but also to make sure that they are green hydrogen ready, because we need to transform away from fossil fuels, and hydrogen is one way of doing that, green hydrogen powered by renewable energy. So we're working to try and get the infrastructure to not be for fossil very long, but in the middle of a war, these short-term decisions need to be made. But it hasn't changed the German commitment to our phase out of coal. It hasn't changed our commitment to our 2045 carbon neutrality goal. Those are all still there.
But if you're sitting across the negotiating table from, say, your Indian counterpart and trying to help India move away from coal, do you think that being able to say, hey, you guys are building a bunch of liquefied natural gas infrastructure is going to weaken your stance in these talks, in these negotiations?
That's not my experience, because I think the depth of the German commitment to the energy transformation and to the climate transformation in this government and to climate justice is quite well known. And I think we're not saying to India that they have to phase out fossil fuels tomorrow. But I think countries understand the dilemmas that we're in. They also see this deep commitment, this 500-page package of how we're accelerating renewable energy legally. Then that gives a lot of credibility. But obviously, we need to stay on it.
We're in a kind of a turning point right now where much of the world is trying to move away from Russian energy, Europe especially. And there's this question of, will countries speed up their transition to renewable energy, or will they build new fossil fuel infrastructure that bakes in decades more of burning fossil fuels? What do you see, if any, the role of your office at this turning point right now?
I agree we're in a turning point, and I think there's two visions of the world. I think there's the one that's really working hard to accelerate the shift to renewables and energy efficiency, and then there's the other that's using it as an opportunity to build in and lock in more fossil fuel infrastructure, which is highly troubling. I think what my office is working to do is to build partnerships with other countries that is focused on renewables, on energy efficiency on a big scale. You know, I heard from one country this week, you know, batteries, huge issue. Just transition of workers away from coal. Germany has huge experience on that. So what I work to do is to offer that up as a way forward so that other countries can learn from the experience that we've had, but also that they have confidence so that those countries see this is the way forward.
What are your expectations for the UN climate summit this fall? It's a system that's built on consensus, and Russia right now is an international pariah. Do you think anything big is going to be able to come out of that summit?
I think, you know, the expectation is that there will be commitments for new ambition from every country, also with a push of how we need to move away from fossil fuels now very present. You know, it's not that long ago where there was another disruption in the international climate space, and that was a president of the United States who was a climate denier. And in that instance, countries joined together and moved forward with the Paris Agreement and the implementation. Not fast enough, but I think if we need cooperation on the multilateral level on something right now, then the climate crisis is the place to focus.
That's Germany's climate envoy, Jennifer Morgan, speaking with the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. As Germany races to decrease its reliance on Russian gas, coal, and oil, there are no easy answers. Follow more of Carolyn's reporting on Germany's energy dilemma on our website, theworld.org. You're listening to The World. 77 years ago, Nazi Germany surrendered to the Soviet Union. Today, in Red Square, a parade of troops and military bands again mark the moment.
As the Victory Day is becoming more and more distant in history, the celebrations become larger and larger.
Notably absent today in Putin's remarks.
He didn't even mention Ukraine once.
Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In the north of Colombia, chaos and fear. A drug cartel is taking hostages, burning cars, and blocking roads. Retaliation for the extradition to the U.S. of its leader, a powerful drug lord who goes by the alias Otoniel. Joining us now from Medellin, Colombia, to fill us in on what's going on is Jeremy McDermott. He's the co-director and co-founder of Insight Crime, an investigative news organization covering organized crime in the Americas. Let's start with the basics. Jeremy, who is Otoniel and the cartel he's in charge of?
Otoniel is head of an organization that goes by various different names. They call themselves the Autodefensas Gaitanistas, the self-defense forces Gaitanistas. The government call them the Clan del Golfo. They are a direct descendant of the Medellin cartel and the paramilitary army that followed them. And Otoniel was a former Marxist guerrilla, later a right-wing paramilitary, and then took over the drug trafficking organization of the Clan del Golfo, which is causing all the dramas today.
Yeah, tell us more about those dramas. What is the current situation? Because, I mean, I'm hearing about local inhabitants absolutely terrified.
Yes, I'm sat in Medellin, which is the capital of Antioquia, one of 32 of Colombia's departments, and perhaps one worst hit. The Clan del Golfo dominate the northwest of Colombia, up towards the Panamanian border. It's their heartland. So far, we've got between 150 and 180 municipalities affected by what they call an armed strike or a paro armado. And it's not just carried out by this group. Marxist guerrillas have also carried out the same tactic, and they've done so this year, where they seek to paralyze parts of the country by telling shops they can't open, by telling bus companies and vehicles they cannot move, and generally creating as much disruption as they possibly can.
And as we've seen with the capture of other drug lords, often a new leader pops up in their place. Is cutting off the head of the snake, is that going to hurt the Gulf Clan's operation?
What we've seen, Marco, every time this has happened, the kingpin strategy and cutting the head off the snake, is unfortunately it tends to give birth to more violence. As a leader is extradited, many others seek to take his place. Other drug trafficking organizations eye the territory and the streams of income of the extradited leader's organization. And there tends to be a push, a bit of criminal argy-bargy, which results in killings and displacement. We may not see that with the extradition of Otoniel. There are several of his successors have been well identified. It's a disciplined organization. We're not expecting a massive disruption to the exportation of cocaine.
Well, now Otoniel is in U.S. custody, but he was already facing over 100 criminal charges in Colombia. Why do you think the U.S. wants to prosecute this Colombian drug kingpin?
Otoniel is the last of a generation of drug traffickers here in Colombia. As I've said, he was a former guerrilla, a former paramilitary. He has a long and bloody criminal history. So he's very much a prize for the U.S. justice system. The Colombian government were desperate to get rid of him as well. There were apparently plans for him to escape. They were terrified as to the corrosive power of the corruption and the armed guys he can call upon who are obviously implementing this armed stoppage and all the chaos we're seeing at the moment.
So last week, Colombian President Iván Duque tweeted out a warning to the Gulf Clan cartel saying either they submit to the authorities or they will suffer the same fate as the man with the alias Otoniel. Do Colombian authorities now have the power to confront the cartel?
Well, the simple fact that there are up to 180 municipalities in the country where shops are closed, there's no transport, and the citizens there do not believe the Colombian government can protect them, I think that rather undermines President Duque's declarations.
Jeremy McDermott is the co-director and co-founder of Insight Crime, a journalism nonprofit covering organized crime in the Americas. He joined us from Medellin, Colombia. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for speaking with us.
A pleasure, Marco.
India is in the grips of a major heat wave. It started a few weeks ago, then this weekend, an uptick of extreme temperatures, with many places seeing the mercury rise above 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Heat waves are common in India, but scientists say the evidence suggests climate change is changing weather patterns and making the heat waves worse. From New Delhi, Sushmita Pathak reports.
A few brave shoppers at this market in Jaipur in northern India line up in front of a sugarcane juice stall under a tree. It's afternoon, 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and the icy sweet drink is a welcome relief. Most shoppers say they only step out of their homes if it's absolutely necessary. They order groceries online and work from home. But that's not an option for rickshaw driver Vishram Saini. As his three-wheeled rickshaw zips through Jaipur's streets, it feels like someone is blowing a giant hairdryer in your face. Over the weekend, the maximum temperature in the state where Saini lives reached 117 degrees Fahrenheit. Saini's passengers include children. He takes them to and from school. Nowadays, he says the rickshaw becomes incredibly hot for the kids. In the afternoons, he says he feels weak and dizzy. About 200 miles away in the Indian capital, New Delhi, I meet Priya, who goes by one name. She says she's been experiencing similar symptoms. She's a waste picker and lives on the edge of a mountain of trash in the northern part of the city. She says working in the intense heat is taking a toll on her health. Her condition worsened a few days ago, she says, when a major fire broke out at the landfill, sending smoke across her shanty town at the foot of the trash hill. Too weak to work herself, Priya has been sending her children to scavenge for metal and plastic scraps. Avikal Somwanshi is a researcher at the Center for Science and Environment in New Delhi. He says heat waves are the harshest on blue-collar workers.
Specifically, those who need to work during the afternoon times, because that's when the exposure is highest. So whether it's your construction workers or your delivery guys, your Uber drivers, all these people are at high risk.
Heat stroke has killed 25 people in the western state of Maharashtra since March. Heat waves have become increasingly common in India. But this year is different, someone she says. The extreme weather started about a month earlier than usual.
The nature and the behavior of heat wave and the extent of heat wave has changed. Heat waves earlier used to be in small pockets. Now these are widespread.
Is this a result of climate change? Probably, says climate scientist Arpita Mondal. But more research is needed.
But what I can tell you for certainty is that heat waves across the world has been made more likely by climate change.
Most of the north and huge swaths of south-central India are seeing unusually high temperatures. As a result, electricity demand is surging, says Somwanshi.
Every degree rise leads to more ACs getting on.
70% of India's electricity comes from coal. The government has prioritized trains full of coal as power plants are running low on supply. But burning coal releases huge amounts of greenhouse gases, which trap heat and cause global warming. Avikal Somwanshi says it's a vicious cycle.
So in a quest to keep ourselves cool during these heat waves, we are heating the environment even more.
The extreme heat is also affecting crops, including wheat. Mondal, the climate scientist, says wheat is particularly sensitive to temperature changes.
If you reach a threshold, then there is what is called senescence of wheat, which means aging, so which results in crop loss.
Amid a global wheat shortage due to the war in Ukraine, India has been trying to boost its wheat exports. The heat wave is putting a damper on those efforts. Wheat farmers across India are reporting crop damage. Arpita Mondal says this is only going to happen more often.
Most models are telling us the future is going to be warmer unless the emissions are significantly cut. And if the world on an average is going to be warmer, you are going to expect more and more of these extremes in future.
Heat waves, she says, are here to stay. For the world, I'm Sushmita Pathak, New Delhi.
Lebanon has faced one crisis after another in recent years. For Lebanese expats abroad, it's been painful to watch. But this past weekend, about 100,000 of them across the globe carried out their civic duty and voted for change, casting ballots for political newcomers. Hisham Zawil is Lebanese and lives in California. He's also a director with the World Food Program. First of all, Hisham, tell us where you voted and what the process was like.
I voted in San Francisco. That's the voting station where I'm registered. It was a pretty straightforward process. And actually, there was a lot of grassroots organizing from Lebanese diaspora groups to make sure that as many Lebanese as possible in the diaspora are able to vote. There was quite a line, and we waited for at least 4 hours to get in to vote. But that speaks to how important this election was to me and many Lebanese across the world.
Why do you think we've seen so many Lebanese expats voting this past weekend? What do you think is driving this?
The first is the unprecedented economic crisis in the country, essentially an economic collapse. 1 in 3 people living in Lebanon, including Syrian refugees, has been supported by the World Food Program. And so there's really a crisis of food insecurity in the country. The other is related to the August 4th Beirut blast, which is very much a rallying cry and almost the most obscene symbolic example of the criminal incompetence of the Lebanese regime.
That bomb blast at the port of Beirut in 2020, I mean, people are still dealing with the shattered homes near the port, not to mention injuries.
Not only the shattered homes, the port is still completely destroyed. This blast claimed more than 200 lives, but also the blast has really led to a collective trauma across all Lebanese. You know, I'm fortunate to be living in California and privileged, but both my sisters were in Beirut at the time, and they certainly felt it. So not only the economic damage that happened, but there's a really deep PTSD that lives in a lot of Lebanese. It's very hurtful and something that we really need justice to be able to work through.
When you went to the ballot box this weekend, Hisham, what were the issues that you cared most about when making your decision about who to vote for?
I would say, first and foremost, it's getting the country out of the unprecedented economic collapse. Lebanon desperately needs an emergency economic stabilization program with some solid economic, monetary, and fiscal policies and a plan. This starts with things such as restructuring the debt. There's a $70 billion hole in the Lebanese financial system, including the banks as well as the central bank. Unfortunately, what we've seen over the past 2 years is an intentional policy by the ruling class to not do anything. And so that comes on the top of my mind.
So, Hisham, there are those Lebanese who have left the country. There are those who remain for various reasons. I'm just wondering if you think Lebanese expats should have as much a say in the election as people who live in Lebanon.
Something that I was grappling with a lot as I stood in line in San Francisco and I saw images of kilometer-long lines in Dubai or Montreal or Paris. I think a lot of the Lebanese are outside of Lebanon, are there not out of our own volition. My mother is still in Lebanon. I have a lot of family there. And so we are out of Lebanon because we've been forced out by criminal economic policies. And a lot of Lebanese also left over the past 2 years as well, an unprecedented exodus of Lebanon. And so we're intimately tied to Lebanon through family, through friends, etc. And so if we are able to hold those that led to our exodus accountable through our vote, I think we have the right and the responsibility to do that.
Hisham Zawil is a Lebanese expat living in California and is also a director with the World Food Program US. Thank you very much for being with us and talking about this.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
When it comes to reining in big tech, lawmakers around the world talk a big game. But now the European Union has put some muscle behind that. The EU is expected soon to formally pass the new Digital Services Act. It aims to improve transparency on major platforms like Facebook. Massive fines await companies that try and get around this. Samir Jain is the policy director for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Samir, what does this law actually do? And if I'm online, how could the platforms I use start changing?
It really is a far-reaching and extensive law and touches on a lot of different issues. Among other things, what the DSA will do is increase transparency so that the platforms are going to be required to provide more information both to users and to others about, for example, how they make decisions about whether to remove content because it violates their terms of service. It also requires that the platforms engage in pretty extensive due diligence about the risks that their platforms are creating for things like the dissemination of objectionable content, and then put in place risk mitigation measures that have to be shared with regulators as well.
Would you say the law offers real progress when it comes to the regulation of technology?
I think it does. It really, for the first time in any major country, puts in place a pretty extensive set of obligations and a framework.
So violators of the law, what kind of fines will they be facing?
Well, in theory, a violator of the law could face a fine of up to 6% of their annual revenue. The mere threat of a fine of that level means that platforms have no choice but to take this really seriously.
So you said a moment ago it is a far-reaching and extensive law. Are there areas where it maybe goes too far?
I think potentially, yeah. There's at the very last minute, there was an introduction of what the regulators called a crisis response mechanism, which would have endowed the European Commission with almost unilateral power to declare a state of emergency and then require platforms to take actions like removing content. Now, it appears during negotiations that that was dialed back to some degree. Another example is there's an obligation there for platforms to have personnel located within countries who are personally liable. The ostensible reason for that is so that there's, you know, someone that the regulators can contact. The problem is that in other countries, that kind of a provision has been used basically, you know, to threaten arrest of the employee if the platform, you know, doesn't take down content that the government finds objectionable. So it becomes a sort of a hostage-taking mechanism.
It really seems that whistleblowers have played a role in bringing to light abuse on these tech platforms. I'm thinking of Christopher Wiley, who disclosed how Cambridge Analytica grabbed Facebook user data to potentially manipulate voters. Do you see a link between these whistleblowers and this new law?
I think to some degree, regulators in Europe were probably headed in a similar direction anyway. But I think those whistleblowers, as well as Francis Haugen, who provided information about Facebook, definitely reinforced and gave momentum to this law.
Is the EU leading when it comes to tech regulation?
Oh, I think there's no question but that they are. That the, you know, the US talks a lot, but really hasn't passed any significant laws. And so I think European law has sort of become a global model. And I think the DSA is likely to play that similar kind of role.
Now that this law is almost across the finish line, Samir, what are you keeping an eye on?
Well, there are a lot of details to be worked out in terms of what a lot of these general principles mean, how they will be implemented and enforced. So there's a lot more to come here, I think.
Samir Jain is the policy director for the Center for Democracy and Technology, speaking with us about the new EU law, the Digital Services Act. Samir, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we heard earlier on the show, today, May 9th, is a big deal in Russia. It's known as Victory Day, the annual commemoration of the Soviet defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. 77 years ago, Soviet leader Joseph Stalin took to the airwaves. He said fascist Germany has bowed before the Red Army and acknowledged defeat. Just a few years before that, many thought Germany would quickly crush the Soviet Union. That didn't happen, but what the Soviets had to sacrifice was massive. Some historians estimate that for every American soldier killed fighting the Germans, 80 Soviet soldiers died. Valery Zusati is here to explain how that history of defeating Nazi Germany resonates for Russians today. He's a visiting professor at the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Kansas. Valery, this isn't just a day off of work for Russians. It is key to who they are. It's key to Russian identity today. Why is that connection so hardwired nearly 80 years after the war?
Immediately after the war in the 1940s, this holiday was not celebrated at all because the country was devastated. There was nothing good about it, basically. So for Stalin, it was not something that people would like to celebrate.
So why today is it so important?
Well, later it became a holiday after Stalin, and then it was celebrated quite widely under Khrushchev, under Brezhnev especially. In the 1990s, it was a relatively modest holiday, nothing like it became under Vladimir Putin. So, of course, it resonates with people because almost every family in Russia has some connection, some personal connection to the war, in a sense that grandfather died in those battles or participated in them. But at the same time, from Putin's perspective, May 9th puts Russia on the world map as a great power. And Putin uses it to message to the world that, you know, Russia is still that type of a power in the club of the great nations.
I mean, it wasn't just families, though, remembering their grandfather who died in World War II. I mean, 27 million Russian soldiers and civilians died. That depth of impact on the Soviet people must be enormous then and even still.
Yes, demographers actually say that those losses are still actually echoing in modern Russia. But as the time goes by, you know, younger generations will not necessarily connect to all these intricacies, even though it is instilled by the state, the ideology of this victory. And of course, it was the Soviet Union and nobody else, or with very little help from other countries. And also, since it is not a religious holiday, it brings together people regardless of their religious affiliations, beliefs, and things like this.
The Soviet Union lost as many as 27 million soldiers and civilians in World War II. Do Russians today think that sacrifice is understood and acknowledged in the West?
I wouldn't say Russians as a whole, but the authorities definitely emphasize this again and again, that the West does not value the sacrifice that Russians made in the Second World War. But at the same time, a lot of information that was concealed during the Soviet Union came to forefront in the past 30 years, such as the fact that actually the Soviet Union cooperated with Germany up to 1941.
Now, when I was in Russia in 2019, Valery, it was May, and I witnessed Victory Day in Nizhny Novgorod, a decent-sized city, but not Russia's biggest. And I was struck how even in the smaller city, the day just like shut everything down. But at the military parade, there were not throngs of people. What does this day mean to young Russians in remote cities or regions?
Younger generations oftentimes are less interested in this holiday because obviously it celebrates something very distant. But there has been sustained effort by the Russian state to make this holiday more important and more visible in public spaces.
I'm speaking about the Russian national holiday of May 9th, Victory Day, with Valery Zusaty, a visiting professor at the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Kansas. So does that kind of one-country messaging around Victory Day, does it have any special significance this year as Russia wages war on Ukraine, a country it sees as historically connected to Russia?
So the message today at the parade in Moscow, he didn't even mention Ukraine once, despite the war that has been raging there for more than 2 months now. It's not going well, apparently, for President Putin. He mentioned Donbass, which is the eastern part of Ukraine.
So if we look at Ukraine, I mean, I'm guessing Ukrainians remember May 9th, Victory Day, very differently than the Russians. What is the difference?
None of the former Soviet Union countries celebrates this day on this scale as Russia.
And let me just jump in there. Did they celebrate it during the Soviet period in the same way as Russia did?
They had to. It wasn't their choice or something.
Right.
It was centrally planned, so they had to.
But it became more lavish under Putin.
Definitely. And also, you know, before, under the Soviet Union and also in early modern Russia days, the message was, we could describe it something like, never again, you know, with some happiness that we won and the war ended. But kind of, you know, there was a significant sorrowful kind of message there. Under Putin, the message, first of all, it became less sorrowful and less sad and more happy about the victory. And it became more like, we can do it again. So it became certainly more militaristic, kind of more optimistic about war and less sad about the sacrifices and things like this.
Mm. For the former Soviet states and after the Soviet Union ended in Ukraine, have Ukrainians resented in part that it was Stalin's victory they were celebrating?
The resentment was not about the history, but about how Russia tried to use that victory to install its authority in this post-Soviet Union world. While, you know, Ukraine, Belarus, they were both devastated during the war. Their sacrifices were huge. You know, these were the battlefields, of course, Ukraine and Belarus.
So, Valery, as we discuss Victory Day, and Putin does not really mention the war in Ukraine on Victory Day, how much is modern Russian identity at stake with the outcome of the war in Ukraine?
That's a good question. Russians have lived without Ukraine for 30 years. Nothing bad happened to Russia because of that. But territorial expansion has been Russians' way of life for generations and centuries, actually.
Valery Zusaty is a visiting professor at the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Kansas. He's been speaking with us about the importance of May 9th, Victory Day in Russia, and the holiday's importance for modern Russian identity. Valery, this is fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we will see you back here again tomorrow.